PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is one of the most common reasons that women visit their doctor. And I've got an absolute expert on polycystic ovarian syndrome with me today, Dr. Jamie Seaman, board certified OBGYN, who's been taking care of women with PCOS for years. And I suspect in the first few years of her practice, she treated PCOS the normal way with pills and stuff. But I know that now she has a completely different approach to PCOS. So if you have anybody in your family, your mom, your sister, your daughter, your granddaughter who has PCOS or who you suspect has PCOS, please do them the favor of sharing this video with them. You're welcome to share this in any PCOS groups or just on your own favorite social media. Let's bring Dr. Seaman on. Dr. Jamie.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Dr. It's so good to be here.
Welcome. It's such a pleasure to talk with you again. I don't think we've chatted since Omaha.
Yeah, it's been a little bit.
Been a minute. You've been busy. I've been busy. But today we've gathered together to talk about something very, very important for millions of women. And that's polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS. Before we dive into this very complicated, but also maybe overly complicated issue, introduce yourself and tell us about yourself and what you do.
So I am a board certified OBGYN, which means that I deliver babies and do surgery and see women all the way from teenage patients to menopausal women in my practice. So I work full time. I literally just got out of the operating room to come jump on this live right now. So that's my full-time job, but I wear a lot of other hats. I run a social media, Dr. Fit and Fabulous. I'm sure people watching are some of my followers. And if you're not, I would love to have you. I really try to educate the world, not only on women's health stuff, sexual health, PCOS, what we're going to talk about today, obstetrics and gynecology issues, but really metabolic disease in general, because it affects women in a lot of different ways and can be the root cause of a lot of things that I treat. But I'm also a mom to three daughters, which makes me extra passionate about all the things that we're talking about, because they are going to grow up and encounter the things that I've encountered. And today's topic in particular is very personal to me, because when I was trying to get pregnant with my first daughter, my doctor said, I think you have PCOS, and I was placed on a lot of different medications, had to use some medications to help me help achieve my first pregnancy. So very near and dear to me. And I'm just thankful for the opportunity to be on your platform talking about it.
So did I understand you correctly that you were diagnosed yourself with PCOS at one point?
Yeah. So I'm always very transparent with my own health and my own health journey. I kind of live on social media a little bit. So the story is I grew up as an athlete. It was always kind of that athletic build, could lift a lot of weights, build muscle very easily, which is not uncommon with PCOS patients. Actually, if you pull the number of collegiate and professional athletes that at one point in time had PCOS, a ton of them did, because it's advantageous from that standpoint to have hyperandrogenism, to have extra testosterone. Sure. And in college, I got on birth control and had been on birth control for a number of years, met my husband, we went to medical school, and I wanted to get pregnant. So I came off of birth control and realized that I was not having periods. So I called my doctor after several months and I said, hey, I'm trying to get pregnant and my period hasn't come back. And so, she brought me in and we kind of discussed things. I come from a family of diabetics, like normal BMI diabetics, but I was a pretty normal weight. I was working out. I mean, I looked pretty healthy from the outside. And she said, I think this is PCOS. And so she placed me on metformin. And the only thing I knew from PCOS from medical school was you tell these women to lose 10% of their body weight, they'll start ovulating again. So I went on a super calorie restricted diet. This is going to sound absolutely stupid, you guys. I have multiple medical degrees, but I was on a surgical rotation at the time and I was eating for free at the hospital. And so I went to the hospital and I would just get a whole bowl of iceberg lettuce because I knew that was really low calorie. And I would throw some fat-free cottage cheese on it, because I knew that was low calorie, and maybe a few sunflower seeds, a few bacon bits or whatever. I literally was eating like lettuce and cottage cheese, and I was just trying to exercise when I could. And I was just trying to lose like 10% of my body weight. Yep. She also put me on metformin, and my cycles were still like, I just wasn't getting a period. So then she'd give me progesterone to induce the cycle, but it's not really inducing a period. It's just giving you a withdrawal bleed. So she gave me a couple rounds of this progesterone and I still wasn't getting pregnant. And this was really frustrating. So she said, well, I think you need some medicine to help you ovulate because your PCOS, you're not ovulating. So she sent in a prescription for Clomid, clomiphene citrate, which helps patients with PCOS ovulate. And we tried that month and I didn't get my period. I had a negative pregnancy test, but then thankfully 2 weeks later, I ended up getting a positive, which patients with PCOS sometimes will ovulate really late. And sure enough, got that first ultrasound. So I was so happy that just the weight loss and the metformin alone, I was able to get pregnant. But then fast forward to my pregnancy, failed my glucose testing, was diagnosed with hypothyroidism after that pregnancy, went on to fail all the glucose tests with my other pregnancies, and then eventually got prediabetes. I mean, it was like the classic pathway to metabolic syndrome. And so that's why it's really, you know, a passion of mine. I had struggled with acne, but I didn't have a lot of the hair growth and things like that. And we can dive into all the diagnosis and symptomatology, but really near and dear to me because it's something I personally dealt with.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you did develop gestational diabetes during your pregnancy. And I think there's a large overlap between having PCOS and developing gestational diabetes, because I essentially think they're both caused by exactly the same thing, at least 99% that caused by the same thing. And recently, I've had a couple of people in my group who were diagnosed with gestational diabetes because they failed their 1 hour, right? But in both cases, one of the ladies' A1C was 4.9, and she was wearing a CGM, and it was literally just beauty all day, 24/7. The other's A1C was 5.0, again, wearing a CGM because that's what I recommended, and it was just beautiful, 83 all day long, no matter what. But yet they were still diagnosed with gestational diabetes. So let's divert just for a second and let's talk about that. Was that diagnosis, was that just a blind thoughtless diagnosis of gestational diabetes, or was that a useful diagnosis that they made despite the pristine A1Cs and the flatline CGMs?
Okay, so I want to unpack this twofold. The first one is that in one of my pregnancies, I failed the 1 hour, but passed the 3 hour test, but I still ended up having all babies that were like close to 9 pounds. So when patients fail a 1 hour and pass the 3 hour, these patients still have a level of insulin resistance that is clinically significant. And we know this from a lot of studies, the HAPO trial. We just have to pick a cutoff somewhere, but there's right. This large proportion of population that thinks they are safe and they're not, and it causes lots of bad outcomes. So that's like one thing I want to unpack is you can definitely have that. These patients that you're referring to, and I don't know what the diet was like of these patients, if they were low carbohydrate, I'm assuming if they're your follower, they were. And so in patients, traditional glucose tolerance testing in people who eat low carb is not reliable. So you have to prime the pancreas for insulin secretion. And so your pancreas is always trying to kind of say, how many carbs are coming in? How much insulin do I need to make? So in patients that are low carb, a traditional 1 hour glucose tolerance test is going to give you a lot of false positives because that patient isn't used to a 50 gram glucose challenge and they don't have, their insulin isn't primed to deal with that. And so just know that anybody eating low carb, I don't recommend doing a 1 hour test. You will find patients that pass it, or you can actually do a little bit of carb loading the day or two prior and fool the test essentially. But in these patients, a lot of times if they fail it, then we look at their glucose testing. Oh my God, it looks pristine. Cool. Keep doing whatever you're doing. But back to this idea of failing the 1 hour and passing the 3 hour is that we always have to be asking, regardless of pregnancy or not, are the blood sugars normal at the cost of what amount of insulin? If you're low carb and your blood sugars are normal, very low cost of insulin. If you're insulin resistant, you may have normal blood sugars for a long time at the cost of a ton of insulin. And that was where I was living, you know, during my diagnosis and my pregnancies and things like that. And so that's the one we always have to think about is how much insulin is making the blood sugars normal or abnormal. And because that's where the pathology lies.
Oh, I totally agree. And when I was doing the research for my PCOS videos on this channel, what I kept finding again and again in the research was that effectively every single woman diagnosed with PCOS also had hyperinsulinemia, which, you know, we talk about as insulin resistance, but really there's a black and white number. You can check a fasting insulin. And so if someone has a normal A1C and they have a normal 1 hour, but you check their insulin level and it's 47, they're hyperinsulinemic. And that just that high insulin level means that they're at much higher risk for both PCOS and gestational diabetes, I think. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. So when we think about the progression to insulin resistance, then to prediabetes, then to type 2 diabetes, it starts with hyperinsulinemia. So the body will continue to put out tons of insulin in an attempt to make the glucose normal. As the insulin resistance gets really bad, the blood sugars will start to rise. And the first thing you'll see is an elevation in the fasting glucose level and the fasting insulin level. Then eventually, years, months, years down the road, the A1C will eventually rise. So if you have an elevated A1C, this has been going on for a long time, even though the hemoglobin A1C is a 3-month average of what's been happening with your blood sugars, that's the last thing that starts to rise. So if you're only using that as a screening method, you're missing a huge proportion of patients that really need intervention now before it ever progresses. And just to give everybody a little bit of a positive note, is that because you can go up, you can go down. So this is something where you can have years and years of insulin resistance. You can go back down on the spectrum. You can normalize the glucose levels. You can normalize the fasting insulin levels. But it takes time to kind of, you know, unpack this and to reverse some of this damage. But you can fix it. It is reversible as long as you have a functioning pancreas and liver.
Yes, I love it. Now, if you don't mind, Doc, I'm going to take questions as I see them come in during this, and then we'll just jump right back on topic. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. Question from Heartland Soap and Sundries. Can you please talk about what I can do for HydroSalpinx block tubes and not do IVF? I've had textbook PCOS for around 14 years, but she thinks that she can ovulate. What do you say about that?
Yeah. So this is a difficult situation because to get pregnant, we need the egg to release a good egg. We need the sperm to meet that egg for fertilization, which typically happens near the tube and near the ovary. We need that embryo to travel down the tube and implant in the endometrial lining and then establish a blood supply to grow. So if you have what we call a HydroSalpinx, which is a dilated tube, and the dilated tube is typically filled with a lot of like mucin, mucus, a watery fluid. These tubes are real thin, you guys. They're like thinner than the thinnest piece of angel hair pasta you've ever seen. Oh, your followers don't eat pasta. They don't know what I'm talking about.
But it's
real thin. And it has these little cilia in it. And they move that egg down. And so when these tubes get dilated and they get distended with fluid, they can be damaged for a variety of reasons, a history of smoking, a history of a pelvic infection, a history of an ectopic pregnancy. When those tubes get damaged, unfortunately, they don't work. They can be completely blocked, meaning nothing can get through a sperm or an egg. Now, if you have one good tube and you're ovulating, you can achieve a pregnancy with one good tube. But if you have two blocked tubes, there is no way to get that egg to meet the sperm. And unfortunately, in this situation, you may be left with thinking about in vitro fertilization, where we retrieve the egg, we fertilize it, and then we put it back into the uterus. But at least if you have a normal cavity, you can still carry your own pregnancy.
Yes. Now, hyperinsulinemia, because when we think about PCOS, and I remember in the first few years of my medical practice, I would check a DHEA, I would check the testosterone level, I would check all the different hormones, LH, FSH. And I thought that there was just some weird amorphous abnormality of the ovaries of a woman with PCOS that just made her have high testosterone, and then her adrenal glands gave her high DHEA. I didn't understand the umbrella concept back then of hyperinsulinemia literally mucks up every single one of those pathways and leads to those hormonal abnormalities. Unpack PCOS for us. Go over the most common symptoms and kind of the pathophysiology of how we take a normal, young, healthy woman, we feed her improperly for long enough, and the following things happen.
So PCOS is a spectrum. So not all PCOS patients, what we call phenotypically, meaning like they don't look the same clinically. you don't have to be obese to have PCOS. There are patients that have what we call lean PCOS, meaning their normal BMI, normal body fat percentage, and still have some of the pathophysiology that I'm going to describe. The diagnosis of PCOS was typically, you need, there was two out of three criteria. It's called the Rotterdam criteria, but we're really seeing clinically, they're going away from using ovarian cysts or ultrasonography of the ovary as part of the diagnostic criteria. And the reason I want to just say that is because it is normal. The ovary is supposed to make cysts every single month. That is how you ovulate. So cysts on an ovary are not pathologic. They're very normal. A PCOS ovary looks very, it has a very distinct appearance to it. What it has is it has tons of little follicles around the outside of the ovary. Sometimes they call it string of pearls. More than 12 of these little follicles that are usually somewhere around 7 to 9 millimeters in size. And these little follicles are what's causing a lot of the hormonal problems that I'm going to describe after I talk about the other two diagnostic criteria. The second diagnostic criteria is hyperandrogenism, and it doesn't have to be diagnosed with a lab test. It can be diagnosed with clinical features, meaning acne, typically along the chin and kind of this part of the face, or hair growth, so dark hair growth. So it is normal for women to grow hair. Okay, first of all, you might have a few random hairs on your nipple. You might have a random one that pops up on your face. Cool. It's totally normal. These patients have...
Yeah, Nisha calls that spike. That's, it's got a name. That's spike. He comes once a month. Yeah.
These are more hairs than normal. Some of these women have to shave. It can get so bad. Or sometimes they have more nipple hair, or typically right below the navel, right below the belly button, down towards the mons pubis. They'll get a lot of hair in that area. They might have a lot of hair, you know, typical distribution of hair on the vulva and the mons. It extends out onto the thighs. They'll get some real dark hair on their legs. And so this distribution pattern of hair, they just have more than is normal. So if you have dark hair growth that you're having to laser shave, and your doctor might not see it because you're removing it. So if you're like, hey, doc, by the way, I'm removing all this hair, tell them. So you can have clinical signs and symptoms. So like dark hair growth and acne. Also, you can get androgenic alopecia. Sometimes when the androgen, the testosterone levels are so high for so long, you can get diffuse hair shedding like telogen effluvium. Where you can get male pattern baldness where it starts to thin in this area, or you can get a bald spot on the back of your head. Or you can check labs, and patients can have elevated, just like you said, DHEA or testosterone. They're kind of going away from checking DHEA and really just focusing mostly on total and free testosterone. But the reason that you have these high androgen levels is because those little cysts that I was talking about on the outside of the ovary, you get an abundance of luteinizing hormones secreted from the pituitary gland in the brain, goes down to the ovary and makes testosterone. Our testosterone in women is mostly made from the ovary. And then in the ovary, it gets moved over to a different cell. So it starts in the theca cells, goes over the granulosa cells, and gets turned into estrogen. Well, because of the insulin resistance at the level of the ovary, they're making ton of this testosterone, tons of testosterone. It's also getting converted into estrogen. So tons of testosterone, tons of estrogen, lots of luteinizing hormone, but you're never actually ovulating. And these things cause feedback in the loop. The insulin resistance continues to get worse. You never have any sort of lifestyle intervention, and you get androgen symptoms and you're not ovulating. So the third criteria is what we call anovulation, meaning not ovulating, or what we call oligomenorrhea, which means you're missing periods. And of women who have infertility, just all comers in my clinic, about 7% of women of reproductive age have PCOS, probably a lot more than that, because that's just what's been diagnosed clinically. But of patients that have infertility, almost like 55% of them are anovulatory. They're not ovulating. So for female factor infertility, anovulation is a huge issue, and it's caused by insulin resistance and PCOS a really large amount of time. So biochemically, what's happening is tons of estrogen, tons of testosterone, and no progesterone, because progesterone is only made from an ovulatory ovary. That's the only time progesterone is made, or during pregnancy. And so because they don't have that progesterone, they can grow the endometrial lining. It gets real thick. If they are having periods, they're really, really heavy periods, because the uterus is getting stimulated for sometimes months on end. And unfortunately, if you don't have progesterone, or you don't have these cycles, it increases the risk of endometrial cancer, so uterine cancer for these patients. And then because of the high testosterone and the high estrogen, it increases their lifetime risk of other estrogen-related cancers, colon and breast. And then the high androgens and the insulin resistance increase the risk of metabolic syndrome. So they develop high blood pressure, they develop high fasting glucose and insulin, and they develop cardiovascular disease and diabetes at much, much, much larger rates. So that's why it's super important to talk about treatment of this, because a lot of patients are being mishandled in just how they're treated, and we're just treating symptoms and not treating the real pathology that's happening.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of comments go by that women said, I've literally had every single symptom for years, and my doctor told me it was just something I had to live with. I think women hear that way more often than they should hear. Paola brings up a good point, because many women just don't realize that they're supposed to make some amount of testosterone. But what happens, and so every woman out there, if she's optimally healthy, is making some testosterone. But the problem with PCOS is that the hyperinsulinemia down the cascade leads to hypertestosteronism. So Paola's testosterone was always 250 to 280, which is quite high for a female.
That's real high.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to throw that in there. Now, I keep hearing, and I've been saying this for 4 years now, but I keep hearing more and more people talk about PCOS as diabetes of the ovaries. And I know I've heard that come out of your mouth before too, Dr. Jamie Seaman. So is that an accurate assessment, or is that just a rough paradigmatic way of thinking about this? Talk about that.
So I don't like the name polycystic ovarian syndrome.
I don't either. I can remember in med school when my professor said, okay, PCOS, okay, but you don't have to have ovaries on the cyst. And normal ovaries always have cysts, but these might have more cysts or they might not. And I'm like, so you literally named it after something that is not required for the diagnosis.
Yeah. It's a really bad name. And, you know,
obviously named by a man.
There's been some arguments to rename it, but in the meantime, it's important because, okay. So what was your original question? I'm about to talk about why I hate
diabetes of the ovaries. It is polycystic ovarian syndrome, type 2 diabetes of the ovaries.
Oh, we were talking about diabetes of the ovary. So yes, the problem is we call it PCOS. We know these women have these hyperandrogenism symptoms. We know they're not ovulating. They're not having normal menstrual cycles. So what do? Is we typically throw things at them that just help their symptomatology, but it never fixes the reason why they have those problems. And just like in my situation, at some point, if they want to achieve a pregnancy, they'll come off of them. They're not ovulating. And then we haven't fixed the problem. And now they're considered an infertility patient. And they have to spend a lot more money doing treatments and seeing specialists and things like that. So it is like diabetes of the ovary. And I always bring up when patients have PCOS, I always discuss insulin and insulin's role, because some of these patients don't always have peripheral insulin resistance. So some of them do have a fasting glucose that's normal, but not always a fasting insulin level. So a lot of times they get screened with a fasting glucose or an A1C and it's normal. And so the doctor's like, well, no problems with your insulin. The insulin resistance in PCOS is different in every single tissue. So they still maintain good insulin sensitivity a lot of times in the muscle, which is great. Why I described why a lot of professional athletes have PCOS, it's advantageous in that regard. But because of the insulin resistance at the level of the ovary, if you really want to treat it, you have to treat it just like you treat peripheral insulin resistance. And that's through dietary modification. The only known way to drive that insulin lower is by decreasing the amount of dietary carbohydrates that the patient is taking in. That is the only way. You can throw metformin, you can throw GLP-1s at these patients, you can throw lots of medications, and it might make the problem better for a little amount of time. But over time, if you're not controlling the dietary intake of carbohydrates, you're going to continue to stimulate the pancreas to make insulin, but that insulin isn't working at the level of the ovary. And so the only solution to that is to decrease the insulin.
Absolutely. And there was actually a good study done back in 2020. 14 overweight women diagnosed with PCOS were put on a ketogenic diet. And among many things that moved back towards normal, their insulin came down, their glucose came down, their triglycerides came down, their visceral fat percentage came down, body fat percentage came down, weight came down, BMI came down, their LH came down, their testosterone came down, and their DHEA came down. So it really, and this was a very small study, but I'm going to ask you about pending research here in a minute, but in this very small study, it was conclusive. There's no doubt that these people who actually adhered to a ketogenic diet literally reversed every single sign of PCOS. Have you had patients in your practice who you've recommended a ketogenic or a carnivore diet to, who were obviously had overt PCOS? You made the diagnosis and you said, look, you need keto or carnivore, 100%. Have you had patients who, I don't know what phrase that you are comfortable with using, reversed, cured, fixed their PCOS using a very, very low carbohydrate keto or carnivore diet?
Yeah, so these studies are small, but there are studies on ketogenic and low carb diets for PCOS. And every single time in every single study, we see normalization of everything that you've just listed. Everything gets better. But it's interesting that I have the ACOG practice bulletin right here, which has an interim update only about aromatase inhibitors and has nothing about dietary intervention. Yeah. And every single time clinically, I've been able to normalize their labs. I've been able to get patients pregnant without the use of medications. Sometimes we do need them, and we can talk about that. But I clinically see a really high percentage of these patients respond really nicely to just dietary modifications alone. I totally understand that behavior changes are hard. And especially when you tell a patient she has PCOS, patients wear it like a badge. It becomes their identity. I have PCOS, that's why I can't lose weight. I have PCOS, that's why my thyroid's messed up. I have PCOS, that's why I can't get pregnant. And patients, that becomes their identity. And it becomes, unfortunately, almost like an excuse for why they can't make these lifestyle changes. So, you know, sometimes in patients, I don't even say the word PCOS. I'm like, listen, you're not having periods, you're having all these problems. We can fix this with diet. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what you're eating. And when you can empower patients that they have something that they can do about it, that it doesn't require medication all the time, that this is really in their control and the ball's in their court, I think that's really empowering for patients, rather than just saying, you've got this PCOS, you're going to have it your whole life, we're just going to have to monitor you for metabolic disease. And that's unfortunately what a lot of patients just get told.
Absolutely. And I remember not knowing the power of a ketogenic diet early in my practice when I was using it to reverse my severe obesity and prediabetes. And I started recommending it to my obese patients. And I had two ladies, one was 48 years of age, one was 51. And they both, one definitely had PCOS, the other probably was on the spectrum, right, of PCOS. And they're like, yeah, I'll do keto. I want to lose some weight. And they both came back, Dr. Seaman, pregnant. One was perimenopausal, but also PCOS. And she was elated. She was at 48 years of age, she was over the moon happy. The 51-year-old, however, was not happy with Dr. Berry for recommending a keto diet because she was done with her family making days, she thought. And she eventually forgave me and was very happy about that. But it was not fun for that one office visit when she was upset with me. But I think people, it's just like, oh, it's a diet. What's that going to do? But it literally, I have had more women since I started recommending a ketogenic diet get pregnant unexpectedly with no help from me. I'm just saying, with my recommendation to eat keto, they're like, dude, I've been trying for 7 years to get pregnant. We're pregnant. Nisha and I hear that constantly over and over and over. Do you see a similar thing in your practice when people really adopt a proper human diet?
Yeah. And I want to say something about that, because typically what will happen is within a couple of months, sometimes we can restore normal ovulation. So if a patient doesn't want to get pregnant, you may want to think about contraceptive methods during this phase, because this does happen actually very frequently. And like you said, it can happen at a time in your life when maybe that's not your goal or your plan. The other thing I want to say is that it's very important to optimize your health prior to pregnancy. So if a PCOS patient says, I want you to help me get pregnant, my goal with them is, let's get you to the best place possible before you get pregnant. And sometimes that doesn't mean the first month that you ovulate. I just recently had a patient who was PCOS, type 2 diabetic, with a really high hemoglobin A1C. And within a couple of months, she got pregnant, but her A1C was still very high, which is very dangerous for pregnancy, because as soon as you get pregnant, a bunch of physiologic changes happen. And so it's not the time that you want to, you know, start trying to lose 100 pounds and all those things. So for people listening, your goal, if you have insulin resistance and PCOS, should be normalization of everything before you get pregnant. And so just keep that in mind, that you might need a backup method of contraception and not rely on your PCOS and your anovulation.
Yep. Anybody watching this, did you go keto and then get pregnant? I've already seen three or four comments Slousberry here. But put it in the comments, because a lot of women, I totally get it, Dr. Seaman. They're like, keto diet, blah, blah, blah. How many times am I going to have to hear about the keto diet? But like, we're not joking. You got two medical doctors sitting here, and then you've got all these people in the comments saying, no, I tried to have babies for years, couldn't have babies, went keto, had a baby. Literally.
Yeah. You can find other studies, Mediterranean diet, whole food diet. There are other diets that you can eat that will achieve weight loss, that can restore ovulation, but it's not fixing the insulin resistance. And so that's why I'm a huge fan of low carb diets for this reason. And then it also decreases the chance when they get into pregnancy of developing gestational diabetes long term. It reduces their risk of metabolic syndrome. So this has to be a complete lifestyle change. This isn't just a short-term treatment to get pregnant, which if you read other studies, there are other diets that may purport good outcomes for PCOS, but it's not a long-term solution. Anything that causes 10% weight loss can sometimes restore ovulation.
Yes. Now, a good question from Kaylin. What about so-called lean PCOS, which you alluded to earlier, where weight loss is not the goal?
Yeah. So these patients are harder to treat, and it's probably because PCOS is a spectrum, and there probably are a subset of patients where it's more of a genetic or an epigenetic modification that's happened that's leading to their PCOS versus patients that are obese and have insulin resistance. It's kind of a chicken or the egg, right? You know, sometimes you probably developed insulin resistance and got obese, and now you suddenly have the same diagnostic criteria of PCOS. Lean PCOS patients, if the goal is not weight loss, you can still maintain weight by taking in enough calories of protein and fat. So you don't necessarily have to lose weight, but you can still sometimes restore ovulation with a low carb diet. You just have to make sure you're taking in enough fat to keep your calories at a place where you're not losing any more weight, because too low of body weight can also cause you to not ovulate. So there always has to be that middle ground of normalizing all the different factors.
Yeah. And I think lean ladies with PCOS are akin to lean type 2 diabetics, right? And so even though they're very lean, they're not obese or overweight, they can still have sky high insulin levels. And the average doctor still, after you and I have been harping on this for how many years now, the average doctor, when one of my people go in and say, hey, check my fasting insulin, the doc's like, why would I check that? I don't even know what I would use that for. How are we not getting more traction with doctors, especially family doctors and internists who take care of diabetes all the time, and OBGYNs who take care of PCOS all the time? How do they not know the power of checking a fasting insulin? How is that even possible?
Yeah, it's really frustrating. And the thing also I want to say, I recently had a very normal looking pregnant patient who failed a glucose test. She was having fasting glucose levels over 200. That's a red flag. I think this patient probably had type 2 diabetes coming into pregnancy, and nobody screened her because she looked normal. Right. So we have to get away from this idea of screening patients with our eyes. There's so much disease underlying that we just aren't looking for and aren't checking for. And you can ask your doctor to check these things. A caveat though, in pregnancy, you can't really check a fasting insulin level, and you can't check a hemoglobin A1C because the hemoglobin A1C is falsely lowered. So if your doctor's basing everything off a normal A1C in pregnancy, it's falsely lowered because your red blood cells are turning over faster in pregnancy. So we really can only use fasting glucose or glucose challenges in pregnancy to diagnose these conditions.
Right. And then also, pregnancy itself is kind of a hyperinsulinemic state. And so the fasting insulin test after you're pregnant, not before, but after, it's going to start to go up, but that's physiological. That's not pathology necessarily.
Yeah, the pancreas increases insulin production 30% in the first trimester. And then as the pregnancy progresses, when you get more human placental lactogen, more beta HCG, these other hormones are what cause the physiologic insulin resistance of pregnancy. And it is normal. It is physiologic. It's not pathologic. And it's to ensure that there is a steady state of glucose and fatty acids going to your baby to help grow that baby. The thing that we always have to remember, like I said, normal glucose at the cost of what amount of insulin, because you can maintain those normal glucose numbers, but if you're using more insulin than you're supposed to, increases the risk of large babies, epigenetic changes in your baby. You are writing your baby's DNA, and you're increasing your baby's lifetime risk of insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes and metabolic disease. So it is really important that when we think about carbohydrate intake in pregnancy, it is to maintain normoglycemia, because that's the only marker that we really can follow in pregnancy.
Yes, absolutely. And there are even doctors out there that won't, if someone's slender and apparently healthy, right, just from the eyeball test, they won't even check an A1C on them if their fasting blood sugar is normal. Mm-hmm. But someone with severe uncontrolled type 2 diabetes can have a fasting blood sugar that's normal, because they've been fasting, right? And so a lot of people have just started checking their A1C at home. And BioCoach has a kit, which I've got. And I'm going to take this in a few days and post it in my group. And I've got a link down in the show notes. If you guys want to check your A1C and your doctor's like, you don't need that, or we checked that 2 years ago, your insurance won't pay for it, you can check your own A1C at home. There's a link in the show notes. You've got a little experience with BioCoach as well, Dr. Seaman. Tell us about what they offer.
Yeah, so I happen to be the chief medical officer at BioCoach, and the A1C now, I love this, because what we're doing at BioCoach is really putting this in the patient's hands, right? We have 88% of the world that has insulin resistance and metabolic disease, and their doctors aren't checking these levels, and so they're going undiagnosed for years and years. And what I said is we really need to capture those patients before they become type 2 diabetics. And so what we offer at BioCoach is you can check your A1C at home at your table. You don't need a doctor's order. You just have to be able to prick your finger. And it is a little bit larger needle than a traditional glucose monitor, so just keep that in mind. But you can get a 4-pack. So you can check it every 3 months. If you're making some lifestyle modifications, you get to see those numbers as they're improving. Or you can check the whole family. There's four meters in a box. The other thing they offer, people might have known, you know, Keto Coach back in the day had a glucose and a ketone monitor, and that's great that patients can check glucose and ketone levels at home. But we have a new app coming out. It's currently in beta testing. And this app coaches people through making these lifestyle changes. We know how hard it is to start low carb diets and ketogenic diets when you just are hearing lots of misinformation from your doctor and people that aren't supportive. So BioCoach provides a community of people and coaches right on the app that can help you with these modifications. You can be doing the testing that you're doing. And our goal is to make it really cheap and affordable to people, because it's very expensive to have diabetes. And yeah. The meter is free and you get unlimited glucose testing supplies. So if you are a type 2 diabetic and you're paying more than $30 a month for your testing supplies, you can get them free through BioCoach.
Wow.
Yeah. Our goal is to make this cost neutral for people, because nobody is helping these people. And we would love to empower people to make these changes for themselves. The cool part is you can also test ketones. We have the most affordable ketone strip on the market. So you can actually see that you're in ketosis and you can start to relate how you're feeling. God, my brain's feeling really good today. What are my numbers? And once patients start to see that, it's just so, oh, hello, we have a guest. Hi, baby.
This is our keto baby.
I love it. I love it. Hey, Nisha. And so the other cool thing is that if you're like me and you're super busy and you don't have time to prepare meals, we have these new BioCoach meals and I eat them all the time. All you got to do is be able to heat it up and then you don't have to wash dishes. You can just throw the packaging away, but they're really high in protein and they're low in carbs. So depending on where you're at with making these changes, we try to make it super easy for people. You can join challenges. There's a community of people. And so I just really, really, really love what everybody is doing at BioCoach. I'm really proud of the whole team. I think it's going to change so many lives. And really, we're trying to kind of circumvent medicine. You don't need your doctor. You don't need permission from your doctor to get healthy.
Oh, I love that. And, you know, I fully believe there's some people out there that don't need a coach. They don't need a coach. They got this. You say 1, 2, 3, do this. They're like, got it. Let's go. But there are some people out there, many people out there who need a coach. Mm-hmm. They just need that leadership and that touch, you know, just work with me, walk with me. And I think BioCoach does a great job of that. There's a link down underneath Dr. Seaman's bona fides where if you want to check out the BioCoach system and see what they have to offer, you can do that. There's also a link for the A1C meter if you just want to do that. Either way is fine with me. I want everyone to have the level of help that they need for their personal journey, because it's different for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love if we could do insulin testing at home. I would really love if we could have a continuous glucose monitor that measures ketones. And the team is staying ahead of all the technology. I mean, I think in the coming years, we may see CGMs go over the counter. But in the meantime, Know your numbers. Know what your A1C is. Check your glucose levels. If you're adopting this diet, check your ketone levels. You don't have to test ketones, but I think it's really a good positive reinforcement when patients are like, yes, my ketone levels look good and I'm feeling good. That means you're burning fat. You're oxidizing fat for energy. And that's what we're trying to do. When you have insulin resistance, we're trying to teach you how to be a fat burner and how to burn that fat and not rely on glucose as your fuel source all the time and be riding those blood sugar waves. I did it for years and years. It's exhausting. It's tiring. It makes your brain foggy. It makes your skin foggy. It makes everything foggy. So,
yep, absolutely. What about Westland's question? What makes a woman not ovulate a ripened egg on day 12? Can keto fix this?
So, you know, what we need for good ovulation and a good quality oocyte, a good egg to be released, is that normally in the first part of the cycle, we have lots of estrogen, okay? And your body is secreting this FSH and LH, and it's getting one of those eggs ready to be released. And then it picks a dominant one. So around cycle day 7 through 10, we'll start to see one become dominant. And then typically around cycle day 14, we get this big blast of estrogen and testosterone. It causes ovulation to happen. And then after that, the cyst that released it becomes a corpus luteum, and it starts secreting all that progesterone. When I was saying progesterone only comes from an ovulatory ovary, and that progesterone gets the uterus ready. It gets that lining really thick and stable and cushy for an embryo to implant. And then if fertilization doesn't happen, then the whole cycle starts over again. And so what's happening in this PCOS patients, the reason that you can't ripen that egg is because you have tons of LH, tons of luteinizing hormone, and it's not making that into an egg that's going to be released. It gets a ton. It's like telling 40 people that you're going to have a party on Saturday night. Hey, come to my party. Come to my party. And you're yelling and screaming at these people, but you're not getting any RSVPs. You don't know if any of them are actually coming. You're just like putting out the invitation, and then none of them show up. And that's the problem. Is you need to pick one of them. You need to nurture it. You need to have the right amount of hormones and things ready for that to get released and then get fertilized.
I love it. This is such great information. I hope all you guys are paying attention and taking notes. And if you know someone in your family who has PCOS or a friend, please share this video with them, because the information that Dr. Seaman's giving, as she just said, is not in the ACOG guidelines, which means that the average OBGYN is clueless. And I'm sorry to have to say that, but I don't think anybody can argue with the truth of that statement, because if it's, you know, the average OBGYN, if it's not in the ACOG bulletins, it's not coming out of their mouth, because that's basically the OBGYN Bible. And I can remember I was in advanced family practice in Memphis, and we actually did a ton of OB. And I came this close to doing an extra year OB fellowship so I could do cesareans out in the field. But, you know, pregnant women, they want to do everything at 4:30 in the morning. And that, I'm just not interested in that. So I wound up not doing that. But I can remember when I was on my OB rotation, the ACOG guidelines, you literally had to memorize each and every bulletin. And that was literally the only evidence based thing that you could say to a patient or about a patient. And definitely if you said something to the attending that wasn't in the ACOG bulletin, you were going to get your ass handed to you. And it's really sad that ACOG hasn't really caught on that, man, diet's really super important for women suffering with PCOS.
I just think that I think that most doctors go into medicine because we really, truly want to help patients.
Yes.
I don't think doctors are being paid by big pharma, because I can tell you I'm not. I don't get paid for the prescriptions I write. I'm not getting paid by the birth control pill companies. I really do think most doctors want to help patients. Unfortunately, in traditional medical training, what we're taught is diagnose disease, figure out treatment. And treatment a lot of times is a pharmaceutical. And that's why it looks like doctors are drug pushers, because that is the toolbox that we've been given. And the other thing is there is a true indoctrination to practice evidence-based medicine. And you know what you're talking about with practice bulletins is this is the leg we have to stand on. Yep. When a patient's in front of us, you know, we're afraid of being sued. We're afraid of litigation. What if something bad happens? Well, I was following the guidelines. This is what I was doing. And that's why doctors are so afraid to go outside of that. And I mean, it is a true rational fear, you know, because sure. our biggest weakness is our medical license.
Yep.
And so, you know, for years now, I have really stuck my neck out for patients, because I really, truly believe that I can help people. And I understand sometimes that it's out of the guidelines, but to be really honest, doctors use off-label use of medications all the time. They do things that are not, you know, we do this all the time. Medicine is really more of an art than a science, and we're always discovering new information. And traditionally, when studies would get published, it would take almost 17 years for that to translate into clinical practice. So, you know, if your doctor's not staying up to date on things, you know, if they're not looking at some of the anecdotal evidence, the case reports, the case series, and things like that, I would love if we had robust amounts of information and studies on ketogenic diets and low carb pregnancies and these things, but we don't. Unfortunately, everything starts with anecdotal evidence. Everything starts with case reports and case series before we have large randomized control trials. But I'll tell you, for pregnancy, you'll never see it because it's unethical to do a lot of studies in pregnant patients when we don't know what the possibilities are for outcomes, you know, for the mom and the baby. So unfortunately, patients really have to take this into their own hands. You guys are smart. Use your own brain. Obviously, find a provider that you have good rapport with and a good relationship with. I wish we had more providers that were open-minded, you know, to say, that's really interesting. Let me look into it. Or, you know, although I'm not sure I agree with what you're doing, your labs look really good. Like, tell me more about what you're, it's just, I wish we had more supportive providers, but unfortunately, people have 5, 10, 15 minute office visits. The doctor wants to move on. And, you know, so that's why I just think that people got to take this in their hands, which is why I think what BioCoach is doing is awesome. Is you guys, nobody should care more about your health than you. And you're the one that has to deal with the consequences in the next 5 to 10 years of wherever you're at in your health journey. So you got to figure it out for yourselves.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And you brought up a very interesting point, and I've never thought of it the way you stated it. Doctors are very hesitant to recommend a dietary intervention like the ketogenic diet, yet they will use drugs off-label, which means it use it for a purpose that it's not FDA approved for. They'll do that without a second thought. Literally a drug that has not been approved by the FDA, which in many cases off-label use is fine and actually it's a good thing that you did that. But yet if they're skittish about recommending a ketogenic diet, and I just find that a little bit weird. Now, everybody, now's the time. If you have a question for Dr. Seaman, I want you to type it into the comments. Be succinct and pithy, but not laconic. And yeah, we will try to answer as many questions as we can. And I want to ask you while they're typing their questions, Dr. Seaman, do you know of any ongoing studies? Because there's a website you can go and check out what studies are registered, which ones are ongoing. Are there any studies for a ketogenic or at least a low carb diet and PCOS, gestational diabetes, menopause, anything that you know of in the OBGYN space?
I mean, we're starting to see more studies, but they're always small. I don't know of any great robust ones that, you know, are coming out, but I want to get back to one thing that we were just talking about. You know, when we take the Hippocratic Oath as a doctor, it's like, do no harm, right? Unfortunately, PCOS patients, a lot of times what happens is they say, well, let's just put you on a birth control pill because that's going to protect your endometrial lining. It'll take away this problem you have with having a regular bleeding or whatever. And it's actually going to make your androgen symptoms better. That's how it's sold. And it does. The way that that works is it increases something called sex hormone binding globulin, which binds up the testosterone. It does help sometimes, especially if you're taking a pill that has an anti-androgenic progestin in it called drospirenone. There's a new one, which actually I think is a great new thing, you know, to think about for PCOS patients. But it also increases thyroid binding globulin. So long term, right, you're not fixing the insulin resistance, it's dragging on the thyroid, it can be causing lots of problems long term. And so, you know, I just think that we really need to think about the implications of you know, what we're throwing at patients. But we also just need to find more tools for doctors. And in some states, it's actually like illegal for doctors to give nutrition advice. Like, how dumb is that, right? The first treatment for almost every chronic disease is lifestyle intervention and diet. Right. So like, where are these millions of dietitians that are supposed to help us do this? So again, back to square one, you listening right now have to take this into your own hands.
Absolutely. Joe White needs help for his wife. She has fibroids. Hmm. What a ketogenic diet. Have you seen in your practice, have you seen fibroids shrink? I've gotten tons of anecdotal comments on my fibroid video that keto, they did shrink from one ultrasound to the next.
Yeah.
Have you seen that in your practice? And obviously, you know, you may still have to have surgery if your fibroids just don't respond. But what have you seen in your practice, doctor?
So fibroids are really common. Like 80% of women can develop fibroids. So like, why do fibroids grow? We don't necessarily know. There definitely are genetic susceptibility to fibroids. There's a few genes that we've kind of teased out now. But even if you have a gene, all of this is related to epigenetic changes. So what happens is these fibroids grow, this little smooth muscle tumor within the uterus, but they're very, very responsive to hormones. So as a woman's cycling, she's making estrogen and progesterone. These things will sometimes get larger and larger and larger and larger over time. There's a particular metabolite of estrogen. So the estrogen metabolism in the liver happens through the what we call phase one metabolism. And the metabolites of estrogen, I like to call it 2, 16, and 4. The 16-OH pathway of estrogen metabolism tends to proliferate things like endometrial polyps, fibroids, breast adenomas. So if you have excessive amounts of estrogen and you're pushing it down these pathways, these are the patients that develop estrogen-related growths. And unfortunately, the other pathway can cause DNA damage and estrogen-related cancers. So the way that you can help these things is by normalizing estrogen levels. Estrogen's hard to test. So when you go to your doctor and say, "Well, check my estrogen level," it's different every single day of the menstrual cycle. But what you can do is normalize your body fat levels, because fat makes you have more estrogen. It increases aromatase and makes you convert all your androgens into estrogen. And so if you can normalize your body fat and normalize estrogen levels through lifestyle modification, exercise, diet, getting good sleep, reducing stress, reducing inflammation, sometimes these fibroids are stabilized and sometimes they can shrink.
What about Ozempic for PCOS? Have you seen that help at all?
Yeah, so Ozempic is one of our new GLP-1 medications, semaglutide, and this is a hot thing. It's hot on social media, it's hot on TikTok, and it's hot because these medications do work. So they were first FDA approved for diabetes, insulin resistance. So these are good medications for PCOS patients. Now, I'll always say that with the caveat. The medications can kind of help tip the teeter-totty, scale. They can tip the scale for people to kind of help them kind of accelerate some of their changes, but you still have to fix diet. So these medications, might help you, but if you're not changing the diet long term, you're going to come off of them. You're going to go back to eating how you're eating. You're going to develop all the same problems. So they are good medications for weight loss. They do help with insulin resistance because they were first FDA approved. Now they are FDA approved for weight loss as well. But just always take them with caution. And once again, medicines always come with side effects. Ozempic in particular, I've seen it cause pretty significant nausea and constipation. And we don't really know the long-term effects of them. The trials were only done for 2 years, so we don't know what the effects of being on Ozempic for a really long amount of time is. So always take everything, with a grain of salt and fix the diet first. Once you've optimized
Absolutely.
all the lifestyle things and you're still not there, that's where these tools can help, but they really shouldn't be first-line agents.
And that's a great point you made about Ozempic. Many, just the average person thinks that, oh, if a medication gets FDA approval, that means that it has been proven safe, essentially for any human to use for any length of time. And that's not true at all for the majority of medications that become FDA approved. Typically, they'll have a 2-year trial. In Ozempic, I think it was a 2-year trial. So literally, there is no long-term data on what Ozempic could do to us if we use it chronically long term. Now, it may be totally fine, but it also may not be fine. So Kathy's got it. This question, I think, sums up just how nebulous and convoluted the when your medical practice deals with female hormones, it's literally an enigma wrapped inside a mystery sometimes. She said, please discuss PCOS and menopause. Can you be considered in menopause for 2 years? Because the technical diagnosis or definition is 12 months without a period, right? Unless it's changed. But she was in menopause for 2 years, lost weight, and started ovulating again. But also, she was on HRT. How would you know?
Yes.
Tease that one apart, doctor.
The clinical definition of menopause is no period for 12 months.
Right.
You can check an FSH level, and if it's above 23 on two separate occasions, a few months apart, it's very suspicious for menopause. With that being said, if you're not cycling because you have PCOS or you have insulin resistance, maybe you're not really menopausal. You go on a
Yes.
ketogenic diet, boom, you start ovulating again. Dr. Barry brought up two scenarios where a patient accidentally got pregnant.
Yes. And I
So,
think probably they were not in menopause. They just were hyperinsulinemic and it was messing up their cascades. And as soon as they fixed that, booyah, here comes a baby.
yeah. Now, once you really actually go through menopause and the ovaries are not secreting estrogen and not making estrogen anymore, estradiol levels will typically be below about 25. So in this situation, I would have checked an estradiol if they're on HRT. I don't even know if they got their levels checked, but a PCOS patient probably isn't going to have that low of an estradiol level. So that's how you could maybe tease that out a little bit. But I am a huge fan of hormone replacement therapy. You know, everybody wants to talk about how they hate drugs, but it is an anti-aging longevity strategy because there's no amount of diet that will turn the ovaries back on. And estrogen actually has epigenetic changes within our mitochondria. When a woman goes through menopause, she becomes more insulin resistant. She starts depositing more visceral fat. So if you don't have that diet dialed in, low carb nutrition, that is when the rates of chronic diseases are going to be accelerated for you. And so regardless of whether you choose to go on hormone replacement therapy, which the best time is within 10 years of menopause, it's much better at prevention than it is at reversal. But my advice for those patients in menopause is to dial in your low carb nutrition, lift weights, because muscle is one of the best ways to combat metabolic disease as we age. Makes you hard to kill. And then, you know, consider hormone replacement therapy if you're a good candidate for it. I'm a huge fan of it.
So Dr. Seaman has a book called Hard to Kill. And I think that was an excellent way that she brought that up. Oh, there it is. Yeah. And so I've got a link down in the show notes if you want to get a copy of that. I've met Dr. Seaman several times. And although she is beautiful and intelligent, I would not want to have a fist fight with her. I think that she would, in fact, be hard to kill. And I think all women should be like that. Lifting weights is very feminine. And, you know, a lot of women say, I don't want to look like a, you know, a Russian bodybuilder. It's like, no, dude, you have to work out for years and probably inject a few things to look like that. You don't get that. But an increase in muscle mass, an increase in bone strength, both of those come from lifting those heavy weights. And I think that weight loss is a terrible way to lose weight. But if you want to increase your longevity, increase your productivity, both mental and physical, increase your strength and be harder to kill, lift something heavy and do it often. I absolutely think
this so. This is another plug for PCOS and the ketogenic diet is that if you lose weight, let's say a patient needed to lose 100 pounds. If she loses 100 pounds through just caloric restriction and she's not eating a high percentage of protein in the diet, she's likely going to be losing a large amount of lean body mass. And then what happens is they get this fat overshoot. So you're skinny fat. You're actually fatter than you were before. And so, you know, that's just another plug for eating a protein appropriate low carb diet. And because it helps maintain muscle mass as you lose weight, which is metabolically advantageous.
Absolutely. Now, Morgan is going for her first fertility appointment soon. Or what are the key questions that she should ask the fertility specialist?
So I'm making an assumption, Morgan, that you're dealing with infertility. And so you're trying to figure out why you're not pregnant. So the causes of infertility in women can be not ovulating, or it can be a structural issue, blocked tubes, a fibroid or polyp or something in the uterus. So have your doctor tease out why you're not able to get pregnant. Also understand that fertility is not just about women. There's a large percentage, about 50% of the time, it's male factor, because men have insulin resistance, men have low testosterone, men have poor diets, low in zinc, low in B vitamins, low in omega-3s, CoQ10, and it causes poor sperm production. So it might not be you, Morgan, it might be your partner. So talk to your specialist about treating both of you. Both of you should be optimizing diet together. Because male sperm affects the baby too.
Absolutely. Well said. Dr. Seaman, thank you so much for doing this with me. You guys, I've got Dr. Seaman's links down in the show notes. If you really resonated with what she said and how she said it, you can reach out to her at those links. Also, she's got a book on Amazon called Hard to Kill. And I recommend you read that book. Anisha has a copy, and I wish she didn't have it, because now she always wins when we're wrestling in the floor. Thank you so much, Dr. Seaman, for joining us.
Thanks,
I'll see you next time, okay? Bye-bye.